I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There, the podcast that explores big questions through intimate stories in the outdoors. We don't usually release episodes on Saturdays, but because it's Earth Day, we're doing a special bonus episode. Today's story comes to us from a professor at Pace University named Bryce Particelli. It's a story about a trip he took on the Bronx River, which runs through New York City. The trip itself was an adventure, but even more interesting are the socio-environmental stories it dredged up. By paddling a river that people don't paddle, Bryce got an inside look at places that are largely forgotten, places where cities and nature meet, places where social and economic divides bleed over into the natural world. His story follows his own trials and tribulations, trying to access nature in a place where nature is not meant to be accessed. But it's also a portrait of a waterway, an intimate look at a river that's come to mirror the places it runs through, and a reminder of just how much our surroundings can show us about ourselves. I'll let Bryce take it from here.
We splurged on the raft, while the picture on the box clearly showed two children paddling a placid lake. It also boasted a motor mount fitting for an engine. It was comforting to know that this raft at least pretended to be built for rougher stuff. My paddle buddy Kwong paused in front of the cheaper one. "Are you sure this one won't do?" he asked. It had one air compartment and looked even more like a toy. "It's only $32. We should have known then that we were in trouble. Neither of us know much about paddling a river. We're friends through rock climbing. Kwong is a photographer and graphic designer. I'm an English professor, and we became friends through outdoor adventure, climbing in Central Park, surfing in Brooklyn, and mountain biking in Queens. It's a ridiculous idea. We plan to paddle the entire 24 miles of the Bronx River, top to bottom, in 2 days. It's so ridiculous that there is no evidence of anyone even talking about doing it, let alone attempting it. Only the last 8 miles of the Bronx River are officially paddleable, with a permit we do not have, and there are no campgrounds anywhere along the river. In fact, I'm not sure if any part of this trip is legal. What we do know is that it's generally a bad idea to take a blow-up raft down a shallow river. Coming from downtown Manhattan, though, we couldn't figure out how to get a canoe through a subway turnstile. "Let's get the raft with 3 air compartments," I said, just to be safe. Plus, at $44, it also came with a patch kit, paddles, and a pump. We picked up a $21 camouflage tarp tent as well. A couple of days later, we threw on our packs, took the subway to a commuter train, and headed north to paddle New York City's last remaining freshwater river. To call the Bronx River fresh is a bit misleading. Through the 19th and 20th centuries, it became a natural sewer for industrial waste. Factories, processing plants, and scrapyards lined the south, while up north, in the affluent suburbs, the Bronx was treated more as sewer than stream. In fact, until a lawsuit in 2007, the wealthy dumped their raw sewage into the river any time it rained hard. When you add in the runoff that happens when you cover marsh and stream with asphalt, you understand why the New York City Parks website says, quote, that they commonly refer to sewer sheds rather than watersheds in the Bronx. I've talked my friend into this paddle in part because I'm interested in this bit of my city and its history, but also because we're always looking for a new adventure in this concrete life. New York City isn't exactly known for its outdoor activities, but there's a solid tradition of people pushing at those boundaries, whether it's kite surfers fighting to open beaches to kites, rock climbers fighting off liability concerns in public parks, or volunteers offering free kayaking on the Hudson. There's a growing outdoors industry in New York. And while much of it is economically driven, some of it is also rooted in social justice, the belief that access to green spaces should not be limited to the wealthy. It's a push towards green that brings both the National Park Service's initiative to open overnight campsites in Brooklyn and Staten Island at the fairly high price of $30 per night, and also the Bronx River Alliance to push for the connected and free Greenway Trail through the poorest areas of the city. For outdoors people who found themselves in this city, it's an interesting phenomenon to explore. So when we saw a sudden window of warmer weather last spring, we decided to give it a shot. The train drops us 13 miles north of the city in the suburban town of Valhalla, where the Bronx River is a babbling brook among manicured parkland. It is late March at the tail end of a rough winter, so the snow is still a few inches thick. I know it would have been easier to do a river trip in the summer, but hectic travel schedules in the coming months meant that this was our window of opportunity. Valhalla is an idyllic setting, with large homes on rolling hills, and the trails are sun-drenched and empty. We walk down tree-lined paths in old sneakers, pushing through the crusty snow, looking for deep water. After a couple of miles, Quang, who goes by Kun because kids in Michigan couldn't pronounce his Vietnamese name, is getting antsy. "This looks good enough," he says. There are sticks and rocks popping up all along the shallow river. I hesitate, but finally agree. We pump up the raft on one of the snow-covered banks and step back. Our boat is too small. While the box said two-person, apparently they didn't mean two grown men with camping gear. They might not have even meant two adults at all. After trying a few options, we realize that the only way to fit is if we lay our packs lengthwise and straddle our bags. Our weight dips us deep into shallow water. It's slow going, and we're constantly using flimsy oars to dislodge the boat from gravel bars to get into deeper channels. We're in one of these fast-moving channels when Kun lets out a yelp. There's a sharp stick barely below the surface, pointing directly at us. It's too late. There's a loud tear followed by air bubbles burping. We jump knee-deep into the frigid water and drag our limp boat to the side. There's a 4-inch gash through the outside bladder, and our patch kit is useless. We're only a few miles in, and we've popped one of our three air bladders that keeps our boat afloat. "I think we were a little over-anxious to get in," I say. Kun gives me a look that lets me know I've stated the obvious. We decide to walk a bit further downriver to deeper waters, and head through the trees and along train tracks until we reach White Plains, a shopping center town among the wealthy suburbs. We launch again, paddling under bridges and between buildings while people smile at us from above. The sun washes snow from the parking lots, funneling water into the river through plastic drainage. The brook is finally becoming a river. "I have never been so excited to see street runoff before," I say. As we head under a highway, it's my turn to gasp. Just under the bridge, hiding in the shadows, is the top of a sunken refrigerator, its jagged edge just a few inches below the surface. We jam our paddles to turn the boat, but it's too late. There is another horrible tear, followed by the gurgle of escaping air. We've lost two of our three bladders in the first several miles. Without an outside bladder, we're almost round. And now, without a bottom bladder, we dip low. While the water is deep, every time we paddle, we now spin sideways. We must look like a teacup ride in an amusement park, spinning back and forth, zigzagging downriver. And we're taking on water. The refrigerator punctured our boat all the way through, so there are little pinhole tears that slowly seep water into our hull. Kun, who has worked as a rock climbing guide and is a gear fiend at heart, is far more prepared than I. He has waterproof pants and a cover for his bag, while I'm in jeans that have swelled to 6 times their original weight. My bag is soaked, and I'm pretty sure my sleeping bag is too. It is going to be a cold night. We pass into Scarsdale, where the riverbanks are lined with glistening McMansions, Tudor-styled cottages and pristine town parks. Any hint of trash that had begun to appear in White Plains is now gone, picked up by a vigilant town-funded park crew. Scarsdale is one of the wealthiest towns in America, named the number one top earners town by Money Magazine, and along with Mount Vernon, White Plains, and Greenberg, had to be sued to stop dumping raw sewage into this river. But the Bronx River also seems like a centerpiece here, a soothing vein of natural beauty, and we weave through the suburbs like we're on some sort of quaint amusement park ride. Lululemon walkers pass by without a glance. I've been to Scarsdale before, to their public high school. It's an amazing place, complete with a college-level library, performing arts department, and tennis courts. I remember it as a stark contrast to my work at the time as a consultant for the New York City schools. Both were, quote, public, but the poorer city publics struggled to recruit teachers, pay for classroom books, or offer any arts at all. Many couldn't even offer basic health classes. They simply didn't have the space to let students run free. It felt tragic to see this disparity under the same term, public, and only a dozen miles away. As we head south toward the city, the trees begin to disappear. The buildings grow denser. City lights turn on and roads replace trees along the riverbanks. The change feels swift, in part because we're losing sun and getting nervous. We need to figure out where we're going to sleep, Kuhn says. We consider a small island in the middle of the river or a crowded cemetery, but we finally settle on an embankment under an outskirt downtown. There's a small floodplain of trees below a condo complex. 100 feet uphill is a bodega and a fast food joint, but the embankment shields us from view. We drag the boat out and pull our soaking wet bodies onto shore. We are exhausted, and I just want to get dry, warm, and pass out. We need to be smart about this, Kuhn says. We don't want cops waking us up at 3 a.m. with dogs and batons. He clears a bit of brush from behind a fallen tree. This'll work. No one can see us from above, he says, and hopefully cops don't look off to the side when they're driving by. We're trespassing. I'm not sure if this is public land or private, but I'm positive that we're not allowed to be here. Trespassing is a Class B misdemeanor in New York, which could result in up to 3 months in jail and $500 in fines. People are meant to sleep in apartments and houses, not along the river. Our $21 camo tent offers the perfect cover. The greens and grays fit with the brush, and the plastic fits with the trash. We set it up and bring our wet clothes inside to keep them from freezing. It's supposed to be 34 degrees, and my pack, sleeping bag, and extra clothes are all soaking wet. Kuhn's are dry. I'm tired, and I want to be mad at him for not talking through the gear, but mostly I'm just embarrassed that I wore cotton on a rafting trip. We rehydrate our camp food and are halfway through our meal before Kuhn laughs. He realized that there are a dozen restaurants within throwing distance. I'm not saying I want to be at one, but it's sort of ridiculous, he says. I remember a girlfriend of mine who hated the idea of camping. She asked, "Why would I leave my perfectly good home to sleep on the ground?" The question doomed the relationship, but she wasn't wrong. Whether you're hours from a warm bed or seconds from it, camping is ridiculous. It is the intentional self-denial of modern amenities. But there is also something serene about lying close to the soil, even in a damp sleeping bag downhill from city lights. There is a simplicity that offers perspective on need and desire. There is time to breathe. There's something important about it being so near, too. Historian William Cronin wrote a controversial essay called The Trouble with Wilderness in 1995 that traced our history of preserving the wild inside of parks. He suggested that we've built a fantasy where we live one life in town, while we try to preserve a separate, managed, pristine wilderness. He suggested that to do so preserves wilderness for the wealthy. It sets up a system where you must pay to access trees and dirt. It is why charging $30 for the privilege of bringing your child to sleep under the stars is problematic. $30 for me might not be much, but for a family living on minimum wage, it quickly becomes something rich people do, and that seems wrong. Equally bad, Cronin said, the separation of nature and civilization encourages us to destroy those areas that are not preserved. Cities become purely utilitarian, nothing but concrete trash and people. The sun wakes us up as birds chirp. This little oasis of water and trees has wildlife on it, and we've become part of their morning routine. We heat water for coffee, pack our camo tent, and get moving. Through much of the northern Bronx, the river cuts back and forth under the Bronx River Parkway, the Metro North commuter train, business centers, public housing blocks, and apartment complexes. It runs with high walls on either side, hiding below city streets filled with fast food chains, tire shops, and carpet salesmen. The river feels as if it's in the way in these areas, something that requires bridges and winding roads, and it is filled with trash. What is most striking, in fact, is not the random appliances or tires, but the plastic shopping bags. They are scattered through the river like lost leaves caught on branches and rocks. Near 211th Street, we reach the Bronx Park. This is the start of the Bronx River Blueway, the final 8 miles of the river. Organizations like the Bronx River Alliance and Rocking the Boat bring canoe groups down this final stretch, including local students who explore the river's classroom. They organize cleanup and restoration projects, pulling hundreds of junked cars and thousands of tires from the river, and they put on community events like the amazing Bronx River Flotilla Race. While tax dollars up north can go to parks, public money is more scarce here, so community groups and nonprofits have moved in to fill the void. It's all part of an environmental and educational revitalization of the South Bronx that tries to reconnect the river to the people who live alongside it. But as powerful as these projects are, they can only do so much. The last census report showed that this is the poorest congressional district in the country. More than 49% of children live below the poverty line here, in New York City. The 718-acre Bronx Park is at the heart of the Bronx. Soon after the park was opened in 1884, the city allocated 250 acres to the New York Botanical Society and another 250 acres to the New York Zoological Society. That means 500 of the 718 acres, then, are pay-to-play parks. In the poorest of districts, there is a massive park that only the wealthy can enter. The trash slowly dwindles as we get closer to the botanical garden boundary. The river becomes greener and less covered in plastic. We paddle around a corner and see a small furry animal digging into a garbage bag on a branch over the river. Is that a beaver, I ask? Or a rat? He pulls his head out of the trash and looks directly at us. That's a beaver, Coon says, jumping up from his pack with such excitement that I worry we'll tip. In 1997, the first beaver in more than 200 years was spotted on this river. It was a big deal, so they named him Jose, after a South Bronx congressman who fought for river restoration. A second beaver recently joined Jose, and from the pictures I've seen, this looks like that second, nameless one. It's a good sign for a once-dead river. As we get deeper into the park, we see people walking along wooded paths, snapping pictures of trees and birds and us. They smile and wave, and as we get closer, a young couple stops with their boy. "Where are you guys going?" the mother asks. "To the East River," I say. "Really? They're paddling all the way down to Manhattan," she tells her son. "How far is that?" 7 more miles. "Good luck," the boy yells. There are 3 portages through this park, dammed parts of the river where we'll have to walk the boat around on private parkland. We reach the first and carry the boat down a thin road, past a small dam and an old Dutch stone mill. A golf cart with two maintenance guys comes over the hill towards us. "Is this going to be a problem?" Kuhn asks me. I have no idea, so I offer them the friendliest wave I can. "Nice day to be out here," one of the guys says, unfazed. We head down a dirt path just as a police cart comes over the hill. The water here opens up to a horizon filled with herons and egrets. There isn't a single road or building in sight. It is serene, and we might as well be 100 miles away, or 400 years ago. As we enter the Bronx Zoo, there's another portage bypassing a pair of tall waterfalls. The path around the falls is short, and as we begin to paddle away, we see two security guards on the other bank pointing at us. I yell a hello over the raging waterfalls. "How do you guys get around those waterfalls?" he asks. "There's a path," Kuhn says. "We just carry the boat around." The guard smiles, nods, and watches us paddle past. The river is widest through the zoo, and the long horizons let us realize how slowly and erratically we're paddling, shimmying down this broad river with each paddle turning our teacup boat sideways. We paddle under the Wild Asia monorail, which carries passengers through Mongolian horses, Asian elephants, red pandas, and Bengal tigers. Just past, a tiny head pops up out of the water. It's another beaver, twice as big as the first. This, I want to assume, is Jose. "I can't believe there are beaver here," Kuhn says. We're in the center of the Bronx, but it's the very picture of sublime, as if we've invaded a Hudson Valley School painting. Waterfowl fly above, and there are nothing but trees on either side. We're alone here. The river in front of us seems to end at the horizon, as if we could be paddling in silence for miles to come. We turn a corner and the serenity ends as quickly as it began. There's a dam followed by 180th Street and rows of tenements. The riverbanks are now made of 100 yards of car tires, stacked 8 feet high and holding back the land that carries the weight of a dozen tenements. While the trash had slowly accumulated from the suburbs to the city in direct relation to the wealth of the area, here it is abrupt, striking. A woman is sitting in a garbage-strewn yard nearby. The building behind her looks condemned, crumbling into the river, but there is laundry hanging from a string outside the window. She smiles at us and says, "That looks like fun. Can I come?" "I wish," Kuhn laughs. "Look at how small this boat is." The buildings along this stretch of river are often boarded and dilapidated. Under each of the next two overpasses, there are homeless encampments. We startle a man who is trying to go to the bathroom in peace. The South Bronx wasn't always as poverty-stricken. Until the 1950s and 60s, it was filled with middle-class neighborhoods and factory jobs. Over the course of a few years, city planner Robert Moses cut up the Bronx with highways, using eminent domain to displace hundreds of thousands of people. Moses wanted to make Manhattan more car-friendly so that certain people could live in the northern suburbs and drive to work downtown. He was at the forefront of a global initiative to partition each urban area into separate sections of work, home, industry, and poverty. Industry would be in one area, poverty in another, and white-collar office jobs in another, while the upper and upper middle class would live in suburbs on the outskirts of it all. His mission was devastating for the South Bronx in particular, where they gave many families only 30 days notice to leave their homes before they would be bulldozed for highways. As he put it himself, Moses, quote, "took a meat axe to the Bronx." While our understanding of city planning has shifted since then, the damage has been written across this landscape and its people. As Majora Carter, the founder of Sustainable South Bronx, said in a TED Talk, quote, "Economic degradation begets environmental degradation, which begets social degradation." We paddle south through Starlight Park, a recently renovated set of athletic fields. A rope swing dangles from a half-dead tree, and the grayness of it all feels like a horror movie. "There was a kid who drowned in a swimming hole near here," I say to Coon. "I wonder if that's it." "Oh God," Coon says, "I hope not." "But it must be. There are trash bags and tires and broken glass, but this is the only place that we've seen that resembles a swimming hole. I remember my own swimming holes, visiting family in Kentucky. I'd flinch when my feet hit sticks on the soupy clay bottom. I wonder what kid's threshold for flinching must be here. At the same time, I also know that if I'd grown up here, I would be the first to jump in. A swim is a swim is a swim, after all, and we all get used to our own normal." We head under a railroad bridge where two kids yell down at us, "You can do it!" We're 3 miles from the bottom, shimmying back and forth as quickly as the slow river will take us. An older man with dreadlocks sits on the steps of a park smoking. He yells a hello and we wave back. He's in the concrete plant park, a big grass field pocked with orange-painted remnants of a reclaimed factory, standing like sculptures against the elevated railroad tracks and highways. The city removed 32,000 tons of contaminated soil to make this park safe for use. "Everyone's been so nice," Coon says. "We've never heard anything but positive things this whole way." And it's true. "I wonder what would have happened if we were Black or Latino or Middle Eastern," I ask. "We wouldn't have made it 5 miles," Coon laughs. "We probably would have been arrested before leaving Valhalla." The river widens through warehouses and factories, while big box public housing units and apartment complexes rest silently on the horizon. This is the land that Jonas Bronck bought from the Mohegans in 1639, over 500 acres stretching from what's now the Bronx River to the Harlem River. According to the book South Bronx Rising, the land cost him 2 guns, 2 kettles, 2 coats, 2 adzes, 2 shirts. 1 barrel of cider, and 6 bits of money. Bronck described his new land in a letter home, quote, "The invisible hand of the Almighty Father surely guided me to this beautiful country, a land covered with virgin forests and unlimited opportunities. It is a veritable paradise and needs but the industrious hand of man to make it the finest and most beautiful region in all the world." Bronck died 4 years after arriving, but his name stayed with the river, Bronx River, and the river gave its name to the borough when it joined New York City in 1898. The river is wide here, at least 100 yards in sections, and placid. We paddle past soot-covered factory buildings, a scrapyard, and along rusty barges. Above, there are railroad tracks and a maze of highways. "There were seashells about a mile back, right?" I ask Coon. "After that last portage?" He nods. "I wonder if we're tidal now. Taste the water. See if it's salty." "I'm not tasting this water," he laughs. "Are you crazy?" There is an oily sheen to the black water. "Okay, fine." He dips his finger into the river and puts some into his mouth. I cringe. "Salty," he laughs, "but that could be my fingers. Plus, it's oily and cold." He spits a few times, but can't get the grease off his tongue. We're probably going fastest now, but the long horizon makes our boat feel small and slow. The shore is 100 yards away on either side when I remember that our inflatable boat is filled with holes. If that last bladder pops, I laugh, we are done. But it doesn't. We turn the corner and can see the East River ahead. I pull out my phone to call Lauren, a friend with a car who's planning to meet us at the New Fulton Fish Market. She says that the dock is closed and she can't find a place to pick us up. There is nothing but fencing and food processing plants here, she says. I see a small gap in a fence at a wholesale grocer, and I ask her to meet us there. We paddle over. The shore is covered in seagull droppings, seashells, and barnacles, but we are no longer worried about adding holes to this boat. We drag it on shore and walk up toward a parking lot filled with tractor trailers. While Kuhn pulls our gear out of the boat, I walk toward the road to wave Lauren down. I was just here, she says. The security guard kicked me out. We take a photo with our boat like it's a trophy, as if we've just summited a mountain or finished a long trail. We take a photo because it is what you do. It is proof. Proof that we stepped away from civilization to, quote, escape from our own too muchness, as William Cronin wrote, and to triumph over the wild. Standing in a parking lot, though, covered in mud and rust and an assortment of other things I'd rather not consider, it is an anticlimactic summit. Nothing more than a trail through a backyard we'd considered off-limits just days before. This bit of nature is not an escape from civilization, after all. It's a mirror, just as quintessentially New York as the busy streets and crowded subways. We hop in the car and Lauren rolls down the windows. She is nice enough, not to mention our smell. As we drive away, the security guard walks out and toward us, arms raised. I lean out the window to explain, but Lauren doesn't slow down. I can only imagine what it looks like to the security guard. A woman drives in and is kicked out. Then she drives in again, and when she leaves, she has two mud-covered men in her car. The guard continues walking toward where we'd come from, toward the river. She looks at the trash bins, at the back of the loading docks, and at the rows of truck containers, but never at the river. She looks perplexed, probably wondering where these two men had come from. One of the containers? Should she call the police? Or send the surveillance footage to Homeland Security? The river probably never crosses her mind. She shakes her head as we head out of the lot, turn the corner, and are gone.
That was Bryce Particelli, an English professor at Pace University. His work has appeared in The Common, Fourth River, and Gray's Sporting Journal, among others, and his website is bryceparticelli.com. Aaron Leader wrote the music for this piece and also produced an earlier version of it. The original version of the essay was first published in The Big Round Table. Also, special thanks to Megan McKay for helping us out with recording. Before we wrap up, Mother's Day is coming up next month. I think for a lot of us, our mothers have had a big influence on our relationship with the outdoors. That's certainly true for me. My mother was one of those moms who always had more energy than the kids did. She'd go on 8-mile walks before work in the morning. She'd kayak all day. She'd swim for miles on end. And when I started taking horseback riding lessons, she'd insist that we ride our bikes to the stable. Those kind of habits rub off on you. But one story in particular sticks out in my memory. This happened a long time ago. I think I was still in high school. My mom and I had gone to Europe, and while we were there, someone mentioned that there's this bike path that follows the Danube River all the way through Austria. And so my mom got it in her head that we should ride the whole thing, like just take off and do it. And I remember saying, like, how can we do this? I mean, we haven't planned anything. We don't have any of the stuff we need. I'm a planner at heart. And so doing something like this on the spur of the moment did not seem like a good idea. But my mom was not worried. She kind of said, well, what stuff do we really need? We'll just borrow some bikes from family members who live in the area and we'll go do this. And so we did. And we had a lovely time. We followed this bike path for a week and a half. We stayed in little bed and breakfasts along the way. It was delightful. And that trip taught me something important. It taught me that sometimes it's okay to just do things, even if you haven't prepared thoroughly. It showed me that we're often capable of doing things that we might not think we're capable of. You just have to jump in and start, not agonize over the details. And that's had a big impact on how I approach the outdoors. So we want to hear your stories about how your mothers have shaped the way you interact with nature. give us a call and tell us about that. Or if you yourself are a mother, tell us about something you've done that's had an impact on your own kids' relationship with the outdoors. The number to call us at is 800-599-2598. We may play some of your comments on the show, and if you've got a really good story, we might even invite you to be a guest on a future episode. Again, that number is 800-599-2598. We've got the number on our website as well, in case you can't write it down right now. Thank you to Thomas Sobachinsky, Deborah Krobendum, Holly Williamson, and Deb and Vince Garcia for their financial contributions to Out There. If you'd like to make a donation of your own, just go to outthereshow.com and click support. You can make a donation in any amount, and every dollar helps. We also have Out There merchandise for sale on our website under the Merch tab. We've got Out There t-shirts, hoodies, decals, and as of this week, we also have tank tops. As a side note, we just got a new shipment of shirts, so if you tried to buy something in the past few weeks and found that it was out of stock, give it another shot. We are all stocked up now. That's it for this episode. Our theme music was written by Jared Arnold, and our marketing and business development director is Alex Egerking. Have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.